Good morning, everyone. I call the State and Local Government Finance Policy Committee, Finance and Policy Committee meeting to order today, Tuesday, March 7th. There is a quorum present. Approval of the minutes. Lead Nash, did you have an opportunity to review the minutes?
Madam Chair, I would move the minutes from March 3rd for approval.
Thank you. The motion is before us. Is there any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, the motion prevails and the minutes are adopted. Representative Greenman, welcome to the committee. You are here to discuss House File 3. I will move that House File 3 be re-referred to Ways and Means. Would you like to discuss your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and it is really great to be back in state government. Yes, and I do have an amendment. Do you want to do the amendment first, or do you want me to?
Let's do the amendment so the bill is in the order that you would like to have it. We have the A-17. I will move the A-17 amendment be before us. Would you like to tell us about the amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This amendment is mainly a technical and clarification amendment that's been raised as part of the committee process to ensure the intent and the operation of the policy language is clear. Most of the amendment is adding effective dates for the policy changes. It also clarifies that the transition to a new voter registration application, when that happens, that a voter registration card that uses the old form submitted by a voter will still be valid. It also clarifies that materials required to be provided in the polling places will be printed and that the electronic materials will be on the Secretary of State's website.
All right. Thank you very much. Is there any discussion to the A-17? Seeing none, all those in favor of the adoption of the A-17, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion prevails and the A-17 is adopted. To the House File 3 as amended, you'll please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm really grateful to be here this morning to be able to present and offer the Democracy for the People Act. It's a comprehensive democracy legislation that invests, protects, and strengthens Minnesota's best traditions of voter participation, sound election administration, and grassroots people-powered democracy. We've heard and discussed this bill, the full bill in elections. It's had a lot of stops, so I'll confine my remarks to the part of the bill under the jurisdiction of the state government, at State and Local Government Finance Committee, the process where MMB and the governor evaluate and report which agencies are ready to implement automatic voter registration and when, and the resources necessary for the Attorney General to enforce the provisions of this bill. The portion that involves automatic voter registration, and I'll just give a, since we're talking about AVR, it's a common sense policy that removes barriers to voter registration for eligible voters and helps to ensure that every eligible voter who wishes can participate in our democracy. A few words about the policy, and then I'll tell you what this provision under SECOV does. Voter registration has long been a barrier to voter participation. In Minnesota, we have a proud tradition, long-standing tradition, of working to remove those barriers. As the first state, as one of the first states in the nation to implement same-day registration, Minnesota has been on the forefront of expanding access to the ballot. But nearly 50 years later, our system is in need of modernization and still leaves too many people out. According to the Census current population survey, non-registered eligible voters tend to be younger, less educated, low income, and more likely to be BIPOC than registered voters. And administrative barriers like voter registration barriers are an unnecessary hurdle to participation in our democracy. Nearly half of a century later, we have the opportunity to take a step to modernize our system to ensure that the voter rolls reflect Minnesota citizenry and ensure our system is safe, secure, and accessible. With this modernization, Minnesota can improve the efficiency of our system and increase the accuracy and security of the voter rolls. Here's how it works, and I'm going to explain how it works so that when we talk about the state, it'll work the same way with the state, with other state agencies. When eligible Minnesotans apply for a license and provide the agency with information that they're eligible to vote, their address, their age, and proof of citizenship, DPS securely transmits that information to the Secretary of State, who runs the same verification checks that they do on all registrants, and then sends the voters a verification card alerting them of their eligibility and offering the opportunity to decline registration. After that 20-day opt-out period, eligible voters are added to the registration rolls if they don't decline registration. And then after that, voters can cancel their registration at any time. It works the same way with updating your address if you're already on the rolls as well. What the provision under state government's jurisdiction does in a nutshell is lay out a process where MMB, in consultation with the Secretary of State, can identify additional agencies that are eligible and have the information they would need to implement AVR. It directs the Commissioner of MMB to consult with the Secretary of State to consider which agencies collect the needed information, name, address, date of birth, and citizenship verification. By December 1, 2024, agencies report that along with the steps and any barriers they would have to implementation, and they report that back to MMB. And then by June 2025, the governor decides if there's any additional agencies that can implement it. By October of 2025, MMB is required to report to the chairs and the ranking committee of elections which agencies could implement if they had additional resources, and which could implement if they had additional legislation. This sets up a thoughtful process for administration to identify if any agencies outside of DVS and DHS, which are already in the bill, are ready and have the information they need to provide this relatively simple reform. Adopting AVR at additional agencies will increase the impact of the policy and further reduce barriers to voter registration. As a voting rights lawyer who's worked on democracy policy all over the country, I can tell you that automatic voter registration is a good reform that strengthens access and security of your system. That's why it's been enacted in red states and blue states, in Alaska, Colorado, Oregon, and 19 other states. And with that, Madam Chair, in the interest of time and in the interest of this being the sixth committee stop, I do not have any testifiers, but I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you, Representative Greenman. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we'll move to member discussion. Are there any discussion to be had on this bill? Lead Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, we've talked about this in the past. We'll talk about it a lot on the floor, I'm sure. There are so many, in my opinion, bad things going on in this bill, and the author and I have talked about, I think, all of them in passing or in offices, but, you know, there's some fairly problematic things. I will not be supporting this bill today, yeah. Which comes as zero surprise to the author. I think that the express advocacy is an issue. The automatic enrollment in voting is an issue. Because that's not in the purview of our committee, and I'm trying to honor that. It's a strain sometimes, Madam Chair. But we'll have a very thorough discussion on the floor. I encourage my members to vote no on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Lead Nash. Representative Bonner. One moment. Let me go to – I didn't see that Representative Kosnick had put up his hand first. So Representative Kosnick, I have a question for you. It appears to me that you have special guests who are here today. Would you like to tell us about your special guests?
Absolutely. Thank you, Madam Chair, and I was going to request that. I am honored, as you might have seen in the back of the room, to have a couple of Lakeville North seniors. One happens to be a neighbor, friends of my daughter's, and they are excited to be here. It's a shadow day, part of their career development at Lakeville Schools. And so I'm happy to have them here at the Capitol, some brilliant, bright kids for our future, and they are going to be with me all day, and they're very eager to learn how the process works. So I'll try to be on my best behavior today, Madam Chair.
Welcome to the students from Lakeville. It's good to have you with us today. And did you have a discussion to the bill?
I would, Madam Chair, and I understand it may be outside the preview of the committee, but if the author is agreeable. There's been a lot of discussion with a different bill that's correlated for the driver's licenses for all. If you could just share with us what in this bill provides, what I'm told is kind of a firewall with that, or to share with the committee and the public. And I'm not going to hear to badger it, but I don't know that we've had a lot of discussion real thorough, but would be pertinent or helpful to understand how that works as part of this.
So this is outside of the jurisdiction. I will be a little bit lenient if the author of the bill would like to just give a brief statement, and then we'll move forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I thought when you said you were going to outside of the purview of the committee and given you have high school students there, you were going to ask me about pre-registration of 16 and 17-year-olds. No, but in all seriousness, and I appreciate the question, what it allows me to do is just explain, and I think when we talk about automatic voter registration, as I mentioned, the only data that will be passed on when someone applies for a license, when someone goes to the to DHS to apply for health benefits, is if there is, you provided who you are, your name, your address, and citizenship verification. As we know, a driver's license is not a voter card. It's not a proof of citizenship. Lots of folks now, before the bill is signed, and this afternoon after the bill is signed, who are green card holders, who are temporary status, currently have driver's licenses. So it's never been a proof of citizenship. What the bill does require, what AVR requires, is that the Minnesotan, the eligible Minnesotan, has shown verification of citizenship as part of that transaction, and only those eligible voters who have shown that verification are sent on as part of the process.
Representative Kosnick.
I appreciate that. So there's some kind of mechanism at this public safety when they receive the application that says they meet the requirements of voting, and then it's shared with the Secretary of State. I could clarify that. Is that what I understand you saying?
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Kosnick. Yes, what it does is it says they have provided all of the information for eligible, that they are eligible to vote, that then is sent on to the Secretary of State's office, and they run the same checks under statute as they always do. But that you are who you say you are, your name, your residence, and that you have provided verification that you're a U.S. citizen, so a passport or birth certificate or naturalization certificate is likely what that documentation will have been.
Okay, I appreciate the committee's time to address that issue. Mm-hmm. Not sure. I think there still might be some questions with it, but we'll let that go. And if other committee members have questions, otherwise, I'd be happy to talk about the 16-year-olds.
Representative Foreigner.
Thank you for this bill, and I will say up front that it is clear that I have a bias on this particular issue as the author of automatic voter registration for the past 4 years and today. But I just wanted to say, you know, the thing that I love about automatic voter registration, and this is why I talk to people at the state fair, I've talked to people everywhere. The really brilliant part about automatic voter registration is that it essentially vets our voter rolls and makes sure that they are complete, that they are accurate, so that folks, when they show up to the polls, we know we have good information, right? It cuts down on same-day registration, which helps out our election workers. It helps eliminate mistakes. All those things are good things. The other issue, and of course, making sure that every eligible voter is able to participate in our system, but it does that by doing three basic things. It verifies that you are who you say you are, you live where you say you live, and you are, in fact, an eligible voter. And if that weren't enough, it then goes through a system of checks and balances that allows us to verify that information also against other databases and other sources of information to make sure that you are who you say you are, you live where you say you live, and you are an eligible voter. And the bottom line is that all of those pieces, we talk a lot about integrity in this committee. Having the ability to have those robust checks and balances, to have good, clean, accurate voter rolls, and have voters be able to show up on election day and participate, those are all really good things that we should all want for the democratic process. So thank you for bringing the bill forward. I know that is only one small part of the bill, obviously, but certainly a fan of that portion.
Thank you. Representative Harder.
Thank you, Chair Cleavorn. Representative Greenman, I have a question. I think I need some clarification, and then this relates to the 16-year-olds. So if I understand it correctly, when I sign up to vote when I'm 18, that information is available to whoever, to whatever, purchase the information, and they can send out all sorts of information for elections and whatever else. So my question, I need clarification. I'm not sure if I find it in here. So if a 16-year-old signs up to vote, where is the protection for their information to not be shared with the various agencies or political parties out there that take the information and send out literature?
Thank you. And I'll remind you that this bill has been through judiciary.
Yeah.
But if you would please, Representative Greenman, address quickly the question.
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think my apologies for bringing it up with Representative Kosnick. What it does, it does not, you are not eligible to vote until you're 18. So what it does is pre-register voters. There's a pre-registered pending list that currently exists. If you register to vote and are 17 and are 18 by election day, that currently exists. What this does would allow 16 and 17-year-olds to sign up to that list. There are data protections in the bill. I don't have them. The guru of Mac Gearing may, but I can also give them to you afterwards. I just don't have the stat site because it isn't of the purview of this committee. But there is a data protection for folks before they turn 18.
Thank you very much. And then, thank you, Representative Harder. Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative, for bringing this. I like what Representative Bonner was talking about. If this is a way that we can provide as much integrity and ease in voting, I think that's a good thing. So my question, though, has to do with same-day registration. In your opinion, I have two questions actually. One is this, and then I have a follow-up. Does this bill, in your opinion, will it reduce the challenges that we have around same-day registration and voter card registration confirmation coming after the voting process, or will this not really have an impact on that in your mind?
Thank you. And again, this is not the Elections Committee. If you'll give a brief follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Nadeau. And I think that for this provision, the more we expand automatic voter registration to agencies, the more folks will be registered and the less folks who will need to same-day register. And so in that way, it interacts, which is if we have folks who are being registered through this process who provide all the information that they need, their name, their address, and verification of citizenship, and they're added to the rolls, that will mean that then when they show up on election day, they don't need to same-day register to vote. So in that way, I think that they work in a complementary way and will reduce, I think we heard in other committees, reducing the time it takes on election day to register to vote if we do this policy.
Thank you. Representative Nadeau, a follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for giving me a little leeway. I've never heard this bill before. So in Article 1 of this bill, is that under the purview of this committee? My question is, I'll ask, and you can tell me if you're unwilling to answer, is that I'm just curious, you know, it's people who apply, 16 to 17-year-olds who apply for medical assistance under 256B, Minnesota Care. I can't think of a time when a 16 or 17-year-old is going to apply under 256. Can you speak to that? Is that within the purview, or
So we are talking primarily about the ABR section,
yep,
about which units of government could be qualified to be their data be used to help with this process. So I'll give some leeway here, and then we'll move on. So Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative New. We went through HHS Finance and had a long conversation about how this would work at in the Department of Human Services.
So I would say, Representative Nadeau, the difficulty in this question and the reason I'm hesitant to continue down this path is, as you well know, different programs that have to do with DHS and the Department of Health require different types of information.
Right.
And this committee is not 100% up to speed on what all of those qualifications would be. That's why the bill had to move through all of these different committees so that these very questions could be addressed. So if you have another question, I would be happy to hear that question.
No, I just want to reiterate, and I understand it's going to go somewhere. I just thought that because this is state gov, that we would kind of have that purview whether or not the Department of Human Services would be one of those organizations that we'd be collecting information from them. And if that's the case, what kind of consent or Tennyson, things would we put in place to ensure the privacy of that information. So I don't have any other follow-ups if it's going to go somewhere else and that's going to be discussed.
I think we'll move to Mr. Gehring and ask him to just give a brief statement to address your issue. Thank you.
Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Representative Nadeau, just one clarifying piece that I think is implicit in your question. So there are two separate pieces in this bill. One relates to the pre-registration of 16 and 17-year-olds, and separately there's automatic voter registration. I'm not certain if that's kind of where you were going with your question about it. It's not that the automatic voter registration applies to the 16 and 17-year-olds who are applying to vote DHS. That's sort of a separate policy. That helps the question.
Does that address your question?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative Nadeau. Seeing no further questions or comments, Representative Freeman, if you'll wrap up your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members, and I really appreciate the questions, and I'm happy to, outside of the purview of this, before we get to the floor, and definitely on the floor, discuss the bill and discuss questions that folks have. You know, I think that the critical piece of this and under the jurisdiction of this committee is that we want to ensure that any time that somebody, folks are already offering the information that they're eligible to vote, that there's they're verifying citizenship, their age, and their residents, that we're going to give them the opportunity to be registered to vote, to show up on election day, and cast that ballot. And so with that, Madam Chair, I think that I would ask for your support.
Thank you. Then I will renew my motion that House File 3, as amended, be re-referred to Ways and Means. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed?
No.
Several in opposition, Representative Freeman, but the motion does prevail, and House File 3, as amended, is re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Okay. We, Representative Jordan, if you're ready, we'll go ahead and begin with your bill as Representative Tapke is still on his way from another committee. Welcome to the committee, Representative Jordan. And since you are not a member of this committee, I will move that House File 1690 be laid over. If you would please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members. As Minnesotans, we are proud of our state and the standard of living that we provide for all of our residents. But right now, our laws are not keeping up with the times to ensure that our public servants have the support they need to keep all Minnesotans educated, safe, and healthy. The Public Employee Labor Relations Act, or PELRA, was passed in 1984. And other than creating the Public Employment Relations Board, or the PERB Board, and adding or subtracting bargaining units, PELRA has not seen significant changes since at least the 90s. That stagnation in our public sector labor laws has eroded the ability of public employees to join together to have a voice on the job, and that hurts all of us. House File 1690 strengthens the voice of public employees and their freedom to join together in a union while modernizing how public employees can work with their union. House File 1690 also adds clarifications for the rights and responsibilities of public employers, employees, and their unions, with some of those clarifications needed following the 2018 Supreme Court decision in Janus, overturning their previous position in Abood from 40 years earlier. And now, Madam Chair, I'd like to walk through the bill very quickly, and I know a lot of this has gone through other committees and will continue to pass through other committees, but I'll just walk through it, and then I'll allow you and perhaps Mr. Gehring to mention which parts are exactly in your committee's purview. But Section 1, I know, is in the purview of the Judiciary Committee and will be the subject of a hearing on that part in Thursday, but it deals with data. Section 2 ensures that our state employees will be compensated in the event that the legislature is unable to prevent a state shutdown. Section 3 deals with e-learning days. Section 4 allows Tier 1 teachers to join their bargaining unit and was discussed in the Education Policy Committee along with Section 3. Section 5 grants due process to ECFE, or Early Childhood and Family Educators, and ABE, or Adult Basic Education Teachers. Section 6 and 7 deal with teacher probationary periods and were covered in ed policy. Sections 8 and 9 make changes to who is a public employee covered under PELRA, and it extends coverage to temporary teachers in the K-12 system and in the MNSCU system, which is a bill from Representative Wolgamott that passed through the Labor Committee. Sections 10 and 13 empower public employees to negotiate over staffing ratios and class sizes and non-mandated standardized assessments in schools. Section 11 is an addition to the bill that adds clarity to the existing right, not obligation, of public employees to contribute to their union out of wages they've earned through their labor, as well as the responsibilities of both the public employers and the union with regard to those contributions. This includes the union having sole liability for any errors. Section 12 clarifies that public employers and public sector unions have the right to operate in good faith with regard to the fair share fees, which relied on decades of state law and U.S. Supreme Court precedent with Abood before the decision on Janus. Section 14 permits employees to take unpaid leave to serve in leadership in other union affiliates. Section 15 governs the data and manner that the data governs the data and the manner that that data must be transferred to the relevant bargaining unit. Section 16 ensures that public sector unions can fulfill their responsibility to work on behalf of all members of the bargaining unit by providing two-way communication between public employees and their union on workplace issues. It also allows employees and their representatives to communicate via work emails. Section 17 and 19 provide for a majority verification or card check certification of a new public sector bargaining unit, while Section 18 matches up the timeline for submitting public worker signatures with the one-year timeline in the private sector. And Section 20 allows an arbitrator to protect the private information of workers maintained by their employers, including those communications between a worker and their union. Finally, this bill recognizes that we are well into the age of electronic data and communication, and it addresses the need to protect workers' personal information maintained by public employers. I want to share a quick story about growing up as the child of public employees. And I remember really, really vividly every time there was a there was the threat of a government shutdown in the news. It was really scary to me and many of my classmates who were also the children of public employees. That even though, you know, and it didn't matter that, you know, I knew my family would probably be okay, it was still a really scary moment for me as a child. And it resulted in a lot of really hard conversations about between my parents that I could overhear. And I know that those public sector workers want to go to work. They want to serve the people of Minnesota. But they shouldn't have to live with that stress when we fail to do our jobs here in the legislature. The other thing I want members to know before we move to testimony is that this bill guarantees no outcomes. Employees and employers must still negotiate. This bill merely gives workers a voice on the job the way power was intended. And with that, I would like to proceed to testimony and discussion, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And we do have a few members of the public who want to testify. So let us move to that testimony, and then we will go to member questions. First, I have Devin Bruce, followed by Laura Kirshner. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Bruce, if you would state your name and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, for the record, my name is Devin Bruce. I'm the Public Affairs Coordinator for the Minnesota Association of Professional Employees. We're a union of over 15,000 state workers across all agencies, boards, and commissions. I want to just thank you for the opportunity to testify on House File 1690. The first part I want to cover is the employee back pay provision, which ensures that state employees are made whole in the event of a government shutdown caused by the legislature and governor failing to reach a budget agreement. After the partial shutdown, government shutdown in 2005 and the full 20-day shutdown in 2011, employees returned to work and had to experience the compounding insurance premiums and benefit deductions taken out of their already depleted paychecks. Although some agencies decided to provide some financial assistance through MOUs, not all of them did, and it didn't cover all employees. This language will ease the financial hardship experienced by employees who are forced not to work because the legislature and the governor couldn't do their job. MMB has raised some concerns around the treatment of Tier 1 and Tier 2 critical employees who do have to come into work, and we'll be working with them on some of those provisions as this bill progresses. The second part I really want to highlight is the kind of the broader picture of this bill, as it amplifies the voices of the public sector workers and updates many of the practices already authorized under PELRA to reflect the modern and digital remote workplace. For example, this bill permits an electronic signature on a membership or dues authorization card, the groundbreaking innovation first codified back in the year 2000. It permits the use of work emails and technology for stewards or representatives to contact employees on work-related issues. It ensures that data for new employees will be shared so that employee representatives can talk to new employees about their rights under the collective bargaining agreements that cover their job classes. And it also requires the employer to ensure that the data shared with them is in an accessible format, which is very important for many of our employees who are also ADA coordinators. Many public employers are already or still operating in a hybrid or complete work, remote work environment, and these updates are critical to ensure that PALRA operates. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Bruce. And then next we will have Laura Krishner, and she will be followed by Edward Marlowe. If you would please state your name for the record and begin your testimony. Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Laura Kushner. I'm the HR director for the League of Minnesota Cities. My department at the League provides guidance to cities all across the state of Minnesota on human resources and labor relations issues as employers. I'd like to briefly touch on just four issues associated with this bill that both cities and counties are concerned with. The first of which is making staffing ratios an issue that can be bargained over. In my role at the League, I speak with member cities every day. And for the past year or more, I've been talking to them a lot about how hard they're working to recruit and retain employees. They're using every tool they have in the toolbox, and they still can't find enough workers in the right jobs, the right workers in the right jobs. So adding a requirement to bargain on staffing ratios feels to me like adding fuel to the fire. So on top of not being able to find these jobs that they want to fill, we're now going to potentially create a situation where they're out of compliance with a bargaining unit agreement for factors that they have no control over, that they're trying very hard to rectify. So that part just doesn't make sense to us. The second issue is providing email access to unions and the data concerns that those are going to create. It's really not difficult for me to imagine a situation where this provision will create serious issues with data privacy, with records retention, with accusations of unfair labor practices, and with lawsuits and with cybersecurity. Cities and counties are responsible for the safety and appropriate use of their computer systems. This provision of the bill allows an outside entity who is undoubtedly dealing with very sensitive employment issues from time to time to use the employer's email system for that correspondence. As the owners of the data, the city may need to access mails for cybersecurity reasons or for investigations for a lot of different reasons. This could result in a situation where the communication between the union rep and the city employee becomes part of a record that is shared in ways that were not intended and which blur the roles of all the parties, the employer, the union rep, and the employee, and ultimately will cause conflict between all of the parties. A lot of cities have computer use policies in place that require employees to follow certain cybersecurity practices within their email systems and prohibit other types of usage, such as inappropriate language or harassment. The city has to be able to hold accountable the people who are using their email systems. For employees, that's fine because the city has the tools to hold those people accountable. For an outside entity that is doing business using their email systems, they have no ability to hold those folks accountable. The third issue that is of concern to us is giving union representatives what appears in the bill to be almost unlimited access to city buildings. Our employers do not see that as reasonable. A lot of our cities have updated their security systems in this day and age to ensure that everyone in that building is credentialed to be there. At a minimum, union officials should be required to follow all guest requirements that a city has put in place for security reasons. In addition, this provision concerns public employers because it allows employees to set their duties aside at any time to meet with a union representative without any time limitations and without any notice to the employer. It seems to us that people accessing our buildings and facilities should all have to follow the rules, no matter what they're there for. And then finally, the provision of the bill, which allows new hires an indefinite amount of time, is going to be disruptive to operations as well. Same concerns as previous. Public employers are employers. They need some predictability and some limitations around the access provided by this bill. And that's my testimony. I'd be happy to try and answer any questions.
Thank you very much. If you'll stay in the room when we go to member questions, we may call you back. Thank you very much. Next, we have Edward Barlow, followed by Tim Palmatier. Welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record and then begin your testimony, please.
Okay. My name is Edward Barlow, and I am a music teacher in the Minneapolis Public Schools. Good morning, and to everyone assembled here, thank you for allowing the Minneapolis Federation of Teachers and Education Support Professionals a moment of your time. Let's see, I've had the honor and pleasure of teaching for 38 years, and I am a 2022 Minnesota Teacher of the Year finalist.
Congratulations.
My subject of discussion today centers on expanding subjects of bargaining to include class size. I have a passion for the process of learning and the excitement of witnessing our students grow into a better understanding of who they are in the moment and beyond. This is best experienced when the learning environment supports the optimal student-to-personnel ratios. And as much as I enjoy what I do as a teacher, when a middle school general music class size reaches 50 students, as mine did, I would consider this less than optimal for everyone involved. Just imagine 50 middle school students in one class. Let that sit for a moment. 50. And it was my reality. I had to scramble just to find enough seating, let alone not enough materials to support a class of this size. This is not just happening in my experience as a teacher, but across specialist classrooms district-wide. We believe that our students deserve the best education with the best opportunity to learn in an environment conducive to this goal. I support HF 1690 because it addresses the learning conditions in our schools and gives students and families transparency on how our schools are working for them. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Now we will move to Tim Palmatier, followed by Pat Brenner, or Benner. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Yes. Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Tim Palmatier. I am general counsel for the Ossie Area Schools, and I'm here testifying today on behalf of the Minnesota School Boards Association, the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, the Minnesota Association of Secondary Principals, and the Minnesota Elementary School Principals Association. I'm here to testify in regards to Bill 690 on a number of items which have already been addressed in part this morning. First, I want to look at Section 1 concerning access to private personnel data by labor organizations. I think when we look at the Government Data Practices Act and what this particular provision touches, it's important to really recognize that that act addresses two really primary concerns of government. One is that of transparency, so accessing governmental data and the public's ability to be able to access that data. But another really significant part of that statute is private data. And here we're talking about access to private personnel data. Really, this particular provision provides what I would consider to be unprecedented access to private personnel data from labor unions, and it really is not really touched on by any other group that might be seeking access of this nature. In many instances, and this is important here, the statute actually requires a change from may provide information to must provide information. What that essentially does is that places the access to that private information in the hands of the labor union and not the individual who's the subject of the data. That's really significant. In many other aspects of data privacy, we really consider what is the individual who's protected by that statute, what do they want? So this really seems to go well beyond what would be what the current Data Practices Act requires. Next, I want to touch on, this is in no particular order, but I want to touch on Section 10. And there's been a lot of comment about this, and it's, I think, a very significant issue. This particular provision makes staffing ratios class sizes, at least in public schools, the subject of mandatory bargaining. This really is at odds with how we've traditionally viewed the notion of inherent managerial right. I recognize that the statute also looks at redefining that, but I think it's important to know and understand the purpose of managerial right. When you look at the statute, as it currently is written, we say under the statute, matters of inherent managerial right include but are not limited to areas of discretion such as the functions and programs of the employer, its overall budget, utilization of technology, organizational structure, selection of personnel, and direction, and the number of personnel. It's that last piece that this particular legislation is getting at. But when we look at what is really encompassed in the notion of inherent managerial right, you really can't have one without the other. When we talk about the number of personnel, we're also talking about the assignment of personnel, right? So those issues really go hand in glove. This provision artificially removes from that notion the idea of the number of personnel. And then also, I think even more importantly, in Section 10 delves into the notion that things such as class size and staffing ratios could be addressed as part of collective bargaining. I certainly appreciate and school districts understand and recognize the concern, actually even provided by our last person testifying. 50 people in a classroom really obviously undermines at some level. But the solution that we're actually looking at in this instance really goes far beyond. I can give you at least an example of what is a likely outcome if we were to include this type of provision and say it's the subject of mandatory bargaining. We have a lot of charter schools in our district, and a charter school perhaps closes mid-year. And we have an influx of students unexpectedly in our K through 5 grades. All of a sudden, we have a balloon that comes through, and we have provisions in our collective bargaining agreement that we negotiated with the union, as this legislation would require, and we find ourselves clearly in violation. But we have to instruct these kids. They have to get an education. What we've really set up here is and I suspect this is not just kind of a henny-penny approach here, but this is really a situation where we can anticipate that there'd be a deluge of grievances that would come on for any number of reasons, because schools really kind of the attendance in a particular grade level at a particular school can ebb and flow, not just over the course of time, but within the span of a school year. So this really is a significant issue and would set the schools up for, I would argue, significant liability moving forward. Next, I'd like to address Section 6, which reduces the probationary period from what is currently 120 days to 60 days. There's been a lot of conversation around this particular provision. This is really significant. There's very few jobs where the aptitude that one has is not really immediately known by virtue of going through a four-year program. It's a tough job. It's a really tough job. There's a reason why we have a three-year probationary period. We really need to understand the aptitude and ability of these teachers. When we take any given year and reduce it to 60 days in a year, we really don't get a clear picture. If you think about it conceptually, 60 days in a given year is approximately one-third of the school year. So this is really just too narrow a lane to look at in terms of 60 days. I understand that there's maybe some willingness to look at this particular provision.
Mr. Palmentier, I'm going to ask you to try to wrap up your testimony.
Oh, sure. Thank you. Sure. Yep, sorry. Well, let me just, I'll get to maybe some of my remaining sections here. Maybe the last piece I'll speak towards, a lot of these things will be addressed, is e-learning days. Really, in the last 5 years, the e-learning day statute is a very good moment for the state government to give public schools the ability to be able to operate with e-learning days. Before e-learning days, we were really relegated to one option. That is basically, we do not have school. This particular provision in the proposed bill actually will require that this become the subject of negotiations, meet and negotiate. Right now, under the statute, we're required to consult with our labor union. We did that with our teachers. We addressed and took input from them. I would suggest to you that that's sufficient. If we make it a matter of subject, the subject of, again, mandatory bargaining, I think, we're going to run into an issue where schools are really hamstrung in terms of their ability to be able to provide services to students. It's not, it certainly is not done with the notion of what's best for students' interests. Thank you
very much. I appreciate your testimony. And next we'll move to Pat Benner. Welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record and begin your testimony, please.
All right, thank you and good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Pat Benner and I'm a legislative representative with AFSCME Council 5. AFSCME Council 5 represents 43,000 workers across the state of Minnesota, the majority of whom are workers in public service and subject to Chapter 179A. We are pleased to support House File 1690 and we would like to thank Representative Jordan for carrying this very important legislation. This bill will modernize PELRA and help protect workers as our workforce becomes increasingly remote, and it will codify many of the changes that public sector unions have had to undergo in response to the landmark Janus decision of 2018. We are confident that these changes will strengthen the labor movement in the public sector, and I'll highlight some of the changes that we are excited for. For example, in Section 2 of the bill, the bill would protect state employees in the event of a government shutdown. This provision would provide vital economic security for workers that go unpaid due to a legislative non-appropriation. Another piece of the bill that we enthusiastically support is in sections 15 and 16 of the bill, which requires that employers provide new hire information in a timely manner to the exclusive representatives, as well as providing regular updates of the bargaining unit makeup, all in a usable format. It also allows exclusive representatives to perform a new employee orientation within 30 days of hire. This is incredibly important for workers to know who their representation is at the workplace, so any issues that might arise during onboarding can be addressed quickly during their probationary period. It's also very important that we are able to contact these workers so they can be kept apprised of union activity that is happening at their workplace, like contract negotiations, MOUs, arbitrations, and grievances. We also want to lift up the inclusion of staffing ratios to the list of terms and conditions of employment in the public sector. Our members have struggled for years, if not decades, with the challenges of short staffing in various areas of state departments and local units of government. This provision will ensure that workers' voices are heard by the employer, and we hope that this change will lead to real progress in actually meeting the needs of Minnesotans. I again want to thank Representative Jordan for carrying this bill. I appreciate the committee's support, and I'll be available for questions.
Thank you very much. Representative Jordan, is there any more testimony? And are there any other members of the public who wish to testify on this bill? Okay, seeing none, we'll move to member discussion. And members, what I'm going to do is very similar to the last bill. I'll allow questions, and then if we start to move too far afield of the committee real work, then I'll just ask you to wrap up, all right? So first we have Lee Nash, or do you want, you have two other members? Okay, we have Representative Nadeau.
Hi, Madam Chair, and thank you. And I don't have any questions. I need to talk a little bit about the bill and try to convince people here that we should kind of relook at this. This doesn't help students at all. This hurts students. This should be this is a handoff to one side of a strong commitment that teachers and their collective bargaining, along with the school districts, have committed to for decades. And this is basically tying the hands of one, or doing all it can to tie the hands of one. I think this is moving in the wrong direction. It shortens probationary periods, like we've heard. It takes power from elected bodies, tries to hand it over to non-elected people, raises the level of conflict where none should exist. This just needs to be. I always look at bills and try to find places where I can find agreement. That's where I start. And I can't find it. I just can't find it in this bill. So I would hope that people that are far smarter than me will talk with the author and hopefully put this in a form that actually will improve educational outcomes for kids, will improve working conditions for teachers, will ultimately produce smaller class sizes that will improve academic outcomes. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Nadeau. Would you like to hear the other questions before you respond, or would you like to just respond to this first?
To your committee, Madam Chair, I'll follow your lead.
All right, brief response, if you wish.
Well, Madam Chair, teachers' working conditions are their students' learning conditions. Teachers are fighting for their students, and they're not being given that voice. Big class sizes hurt students. Teachers want to make sure that students have the ability to learn. And this bill isn't just about education. Let's make sure that our, I've been so proud to see our snowplow drivers this past winter, have gone out of their way to make sure that we can get to the Capitol to pass bills that improve the lives of all Minnesotans. They should have a voice on the job. This bill gives it to them.
Thank you, Representative Jordan. Next, we have Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Jordan. Listening to this, and I'm not sure what the problem that this bill is trying to solve. Recently, it was reported 19 schools had zero students at grade level math, and the results were largely split in some of our biggest school districts. And then two districts accounted for 10 schools altogether, and elementary schools appeared to fare the worst. I don't think this bill addresses student learning. It's for the adults and not the students. I take to heart the testimony of the representatives from the League of Minnesota Cities, some of the data practices requests, and then also the principals associations bring some valid concerns that I think need to be addressed. What I think this does, and I speak from experience within the Lakeville School District, is you're making paid activists is what you're doing. But the Lakeville School District, I might point out, has a policy in their school district against political activity and using the district resources, buildings, emails for some of these types of organizing activities. And of note, it's policy 535. I have introduced a bill in the past that would help all school districts across the state make sure that students are there to learn in an unbiased manner. And part of that in Section 535 of the Lakeville School District is school district employees, while acting in the capacity of a school district employee, shall refrain from any conduct that is intended to be reasonably, that is intended to be, or that could reasonably be perceived as endorsing or opposing specific political issues and political candidates. And I think what this bill does is strengthen employees to be paid to pursue political agendas, and I think that's a valid concern with school districts or other bargaining units.
I'm going to ask you to get to a question, please.
No, so the question is, I think this is a bill that strengthens, more concerned about the adults than the student learning, and we obviously have an issue with that. So what is the problem that this bill is going to solve, and how is it going to help kids learn?
Madam Chair.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Nothing in this bill would allow. Unions are still prohibited from using district resources and dues for political purposes, and nothing in this bill would change that. This bill is going to give people a voice on the job. That's what this bill does, and this will allow teachers and ESPs and bus drivers and public employees to fight for the people that they serve. This is going to allow corrections officers to make sure that they have a staffing ratio that keeps them safe. This is going to make sure that teachers can advocate for class sizes that allow students to focus on learning. It allows teachers to talk about which standardized assessments that aren't already mandated by federal or state law are important for student learning, or maybe are ones that don't need to be included for student learning. This gives workers a voice on the job. The alternative for discussing class sizes would be for me to write a bill that says this is how many kids need to be in a classroom. This allows teachers and their districts to come to an agreement about what is and is not an acceptable class size for students.
Thank you, Representative Jordan. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll focus my attention on the letter that was submitted, not just by the League of Minnesota Cities, but AMC and MICA. Having served in municipal government before, there are many times, and I think one of them is right now, where either due to a lack of workforce participation or a lack of access of employees, that what this is going to do is make it more expensive, more difficult to operate that unit of government. So I'm going to be speaking in favor of local control yet again. What you're seeing in the concerns articulated in this letter, they should be very profound warnings to all of us. From a security perspective, cybersecurity isn't just an electronic method of security. It's also controlling access to sensitive places within a building. And if you allow somebody who has not who cannot be held accountable to the rules and processes and procedures of an organization, if you have no ability to actually dictate what they're doing and you're giving them unfettered access, that is a security risk. And I will line up security experts who vote Democrat and security experts who vote Republican. They will all tell you the same thing, that allowing somebody unfettered access to places in your facility is a bad idea. I think what this also does is this is going to create a local impact note, and I don't think we have a local impact note, but this is going to drive the cost of municipal government way up. Because if you allow a bargaining unit the ability to say, well, you're out of compliance and you need more employees, they can't find the employees. They can't. So you're gonna it's a catch-22 that you're creating here. And it's going to be a very expensive catch-22 that I don't know that Joseph Heller could have written a more scary book than what this potentially enables. I think it's very difficult when you look at just this one letter from the League, AMC, and MICA. It's really problematic both in the four areas that they articulate. It takes control away from those elected units of government and puts it in the hands of, and I'm not trying to be antagonistic here, but an organization or organizations that have a decidedly different goal in mind. And I think Representative Kosnick may have alluded to it, but it effectively puts an activist organization more in control of the outcomes inside of these different units of local government than the elected school board or the elected city council or the county board. And that's deeply troubling, and I think ultimately will wind up being quite expensive for the local taxpayer, because all these problems that will arise when the financial remediation that you may seek is brought forward, it's going to be out of the wallet of the local taxpayers, both through levies of school boards and city councils and county boards. So I couldn't oppose this more. Madam Chair, is this being laid over or is this being referred out?
It is the motion to lay it over.
Okay. Well, since there won't be a vote on this, I will encourage the author. What's that? Well, I don't believe there is a fiscal note, is there?
I've not. Ms. Roberts.
Madam Chair and Representative Nash, I have not requested a fiscal note on this particular bill. I have requested one on another bill that is only on the piece related to the shutdown. And we have had fiscal notes in the past on identical bills that will show no cost.
Thank you, Ms. Roberts. I would, full disclosure, I'm a mediator, so listening to management, labor discussions is always of great interest to me, and I will just say that public employee voices being heard at the table are not exactly, in my definition, I'm not challenging yours, Lee Nash, but in my definition, are not activist organizations. They're public voices. Representative Jordan, I don't see any further discussion. If you would like to wrap up your bill, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members, for the discussion. I think members should keep in mind the difference between a mandate and negotiations. This bill allows negotiations to happen over working conditions. This bill allows public sector unions, who must represent all of the workers in a given bargaining unit, the ability to do that and represent those workers. I also want to remind members about how we talked about public employees during the pandemic. We called these educators, nurses, and municipal workers our heroes. While they vaccinated us against a deadly virus, hauled away our trash and recycling, and fed every single child in this state. These heroes are asking for a voice on those jobs we need them desperately to do. You should give it to them by supporting this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Jordan. And with that, I'll renew my motion that House File 1690 is laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you. Next, we will move to Representative Tabke. I was looking for you and I didn't see you. Thank you. All right. Welcome to the committee, Representative Tabke. And since you were not a member of the committee, I will move that House File 1690 be re-referred to transportation. The bill is now before us. If you would please speak to the bill.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. This is a bill for paying state troopers. So what's happening right now, what's happening right now is that in our state troopers, we are.
Excuse me, I think I made the wrong motion. The House file is, I move that House File 1600 be before us. Thank you.
I should have paid closer attention to that, Madam Chair. No,
it was my mistake. Please go forward.
But what, thank you very much. So what this bill is working on the pay for state troopers. So in Minnesota, we have a an issue where state troopers are being paid significantly less than other police officers, sheriffs, other folks in law enforcement throughout the state. And so they are losing troopers, and we are not able to fill the classes that we have every year for applications and folks who are coming into the system to be a trooper in the state of Minnesota. And so with that, what is happening is that we have a bargaining unit that's classified across the state of Minnesota. And what this bill does is it allows the state to bargain and to use an OLA study that was done and bargain against, not bargain against, but bargain using the wages and benefits for other units, including other city police officers and sheriffs throughout the state. And so that's what this bill does. And we have a testifier, Madam Chair, who will speak more to from the State Troopers Association.
Thank you very much. And if we could ask Mr. Dan Beasley to please come before the committee. If you would state your name for the record and begin your testimony, please.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Dan Beasley, and I've had the honor and privilege of serving Minnesotans as a state trooper since 1996. I'm here today in my capacity as Vice President of the Minnesota State Patrol Troopers Association. I want to extend my appreciation to Representative Tabke for authoring House File 1600 and the 17 co-authors of the bill for their support on behalf of all state law enforcement officers to correct this wage disparity issue. In the 2020 legislative session, Minnesota State Statute 299D was amended to require the Office of the Legislative Auditor to do a compensation study of specific police departments in Minnesota that also included state patrol troopers. Along with the study requirement, the legislature specifically wrote into statute, and I'll quote, "It is the legislator's intent to use the information in this study to compare salaries between the identified police departments and the state patrol, and to make appropriate increases to patrol trooper salaries," end quote. In February of 2021, the Legislative Auditor's Office released their report detailing the significant wage disparity that exists for state troopers. The report indicated that state patrol wages ranked 33rd out of 34. The report highlighted that the top base wage that could be earned by state troopers in 2019 was substantially less than the top base wage available to police officers in most cities reviewed. Although legislative intervention was taken during the 2020 special session to address the wage disparity at starting wages, a significant disparity still exists at the top wage. As a result of the legislators' action, the State Patrol moved up from 33rd place to what is 32nd place based on 2023 wage data. If you look at the PDF that was submitted entitled Historical Annual Salary Comparison, you can see that in 2002, trooper salaries were well above average. The wage problem started as a result of pattern settlement practices and 5 years without contractual increases that occurred between 2003 and 2012. The problem has continued for the last 20 years and is causing a detrimental impact on state law enforcement officers and their families for the majority of my career. Right now, we're in a well-documented hiring crisis that has led to lower-paying agencies turning into training departments and not destination departments. The State Patrol has been forced to have two academies a year just to keep up with attrition. Unfortunately, due to insufficient qualified applicants, we've been unable to fill 63 positions that have already been funded by the legislature. The purpose of House File 1600 is really very simple. It would require MMB to use the study that the legislature said they intended to be used to determine troopers' wages. House File 1600 would strengthen the salary survey language of 299D.03 and provided much-needed legislative oversight for the next 9 years. It's a limited amount of time to ensure that this wage disparity is eliminated so that we can continue to recruit, retain, and retire these dedicated public safety professionals. The language in House File 1600 is the same language that was approved by the Conference Committee and included in the Omnibus State Government Finance Bill last year. I do not believe Minnesota expects its state troopers to be average. If you look at the work done by troopers in the last 2 or 3 years, I think you would agree they performed well above average. I believe it's reasonable for troopers to be paid at or even above the average wage of the comparison group established by the legislature. I urge you to recognize their service by supporting House File 1600. Madam Chair, I would be happy to answer any follow-up questions. Thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you, Mr. Beasley, and thank you for your service to our state. We greatly appreciate that. Members, any questions for Representative Cousin?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate this bill being brought forward. Recently had an incident with the state trooper here in this building, and I appreciate their service. Representative Tabke, or Madam Chair, if the author would answer, would transit ambassadors be included under this agreement?
Representative Tabke.
Madam Chair, Representative Kozak, no.
Okay. Well, I appreciate your efforts to increase transit safety. We've worked on that in the past, and I appreciate this bill. Thanks.
Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Tacky, thanks for bringing this bill. I recently participated in a conference up in Duluth with our law enforcement officers and public safety in general. This is a humongous concern. We've really avoided this, and we're going to lose really good people to professions such as gardening. And so I just think this is, we got to put some more dedication into this, and we're seeing our troopers' roles expand, not change. They're getting called in as the primary into many of our cities and towns around the state. We're asking them to do more. They're doing it without, they never say no. That's the thing about a trooper. Even when I was still doing scenes, they never say no. They're always willing to give a hand. We really got to put some effort into this so we stop losing them to other cities or even other states. So thank you, Representative Tapke. We really got to focus on this.
Lead Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Tabke, for doing this bill. I was supportive of it when we put it in the state on this bill last year. Over the summer, I did a ride-along with some state troopers, and I've done ride-alongs with everybody in my district and state troopers, and they perform a fantastic job. So I had 5 hours in the car with some troopers, and we saw a lot of very interesting things. And it was the only time recently that I've gotten to top 100 miles an hour legally, so that was a good time. But I think that if you were to take a moment and talk to a trooper, and we've got them stationed outside the door in our chamber, they are consummate public servants. They will go above and beyond. And I think that it's really important that we do this bill, because you know, I think Representative Hewitt is articulated a worry that we might lose some to lawns and legumes installers, but these are dedicated public service that will put themselves in the line of fire and they rush towards danger. I think that the least that we can do is to get this thing moving. They perform, as do all of our men and women in uniform. They provide an amazing service and are absolutely sacrificial in how they do that job. So my team, I would encourage to vote yes. I can't imagine anybody that would vote no. Not implying motives there, Madam Chair, before you, before you brought that up. But I do not think that this would be a message that we wanted to send to our troopers across the state, because as I travel around the state hunting or fishing, I go out of my way whenever I see a trooper at a gas pump or wherever to thank them for the service that they do, because it is a huge service to the state of Minnesota. So thank you.
I forgot to ask if there was anyone from the public who wished to testify. So we'd have one person from the public who would like to testify. If you please stay, Mr. Beasley, close by in case we have more questions. Please come forward. Again, I extend my apologies for not asking for public testimony. If you'll state your name for the record and begin your testimony, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dory Leland. I'm the Enterprise Director for Employee Classification at Minnesota Management and Budget. Thank you for the opportunity to testify regarding this bill. First and foremost, MMB fully recognizes the challenges and responsibilities inherent to positions charged with maintaining public safety. And MMB shares with everyone here the desire to recruit and retain talented men and women into state patrol and other law enforcement positions throughout the state. MMB is not opposed to increases for law enforcement. But our concern with this bill is that it continues down a path of using a more generous market-based metric for only certain state employees. Because this interpretation is not applicable to the 98% of our workforce that does not work in law enforcement, it exacerbates the situation that we have now where employees in female-dominated job classifications are paid significantly less than their peers in male-dominated classifications. You, the legislature, has told MMB that it has a responsibility to maintain pay equity. And we have to do that both internally for our state employees and externally for all of the jurisdictions or all of the cities within your jurisdictions. And if the pay inequities that we have today were occurring in any of your districts, you would be getting a letter from me explaining that you cannot maintain that kind of disparate pay between male-dominated and female-dominated jobs. To be clear, if the legislature wants MMB to move towards more heavily weighing market factors when making compensation decisions for all employees, we're happy to do so. And we know that recruiting and retaining top talent is a challenge for most employers right now. We've heard from others on that today, and particularly within the public sector. We know that every day our employees at the state are inundated with higher paying job offers from other employers. We know that any nurse or IT professional or epidemiologist who wants a pay increase can likely find it outside the state if they choose to do so. But you, the legislature, have told us that market is only one of the a multitude of factors that we need to consider, that we must by law consider when establishing compensation. Additional factors like ability to pay equity, internal equity, fair and consistent application of our internal rules and procedures across all bargaining units and plans. And so whenever an entity other than MMB comes in and changes the rules just for one subset of employees, it can and it has created significant problems throughout our entire system. Our current approach across the enterprise is to consider factors including turnover, time to fill, and number of applicants when we're making adjustment to compensation for classes. It's been a very challenging few years across the enterprise for all of our job classes. MMB closely monitors data related to positions, and I'm happy to provide any of that data to you if anybody has any interest, but we've made at least 170 adjustments to the compensation ranges for job classes based upon how we interpret these factors, including for all positions in law enforcement. And using the same data across the enterprise when we review job classes is how MMB has historically been able to maintain pay equity. And so, Madam Chair and members, when consideration like this is given only to law enforcement. Other employees come to MMB asking why their work is not appreciated and valued in the same way. And because most of our workforce has not had the same opportunity to present their case to you directly, MMB is here on their behalf and asking that if you have an interest in more explicitly utilizing market data as the predominant factor to establish wages, we ask that you would please do so in a way that doesn't result in inequitable pay relationships across the enterprise. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Leland, for your testimony and for speaking up on behalf of all MMB employees. And I think you raise an important issue. When women are only paid 80 cents on the dollar for every position, that is a huge problem that we as a legislature do need to continue to address. And I appreciate your being here and raising this issue for our state employees. Thank you. Representative Hewitt, you had a follow-up?
I do, Chair Cleburne. And to the testifier, I guess there's men and women in the state patrol reins too here, so I'm hoping they're paid equally and not women or man makes a difference there. But my concern is with this is if we're inviting 348 people to test for the state patrol and we only get four out of that, that tells us something else, that the pool that we actually hire is so valuable and the money we've invested in them to get to that state as a state is really a concern. I understand the market and I understand what you're saying and that other groups don't have this opportunity, but this is really unique because we really limit these all the way down and invest money in them to get them there. And when we get them there, we have such an investment in. I don't know why we don't hold on to them. And yeah, we're going to pay them a little bit more, but I respect your argument. I think it's there and valid, but this is kind of an outlier, and so I just would like to share that unless you want to say something back to me.
Would you like to make a statement, or would you like to hear what Representative Hansen has to say first?
Madam Chair and members, I don't have the data in front of me that you're referencing, and so I can't speak to that specifically, but I can say generally that having fewer applicants for positions is not unique to State Patrol. Mm-hmm. That is something across the enterprise, and State Patrol and all of our law enforcement positions have a process that they require employees to go through, and theirs happens to be more extensive than many positions, but they're not unique in investing a lot in employees and hoping that they'll stay.
And I would like to say MMB does provide to the chair of this committee, and I think the lead, we received a report, it's about this big, what is that, about 10 inches, that is a full review of salaries and the disparities in the salaries. So there's lots of information and data out there that speaks to the discussion that you're having right now. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Tabke, you mentioned the 2020 special session. And so the 2020 special session fixed or provided a salary adjustment only for certain state troopers. And so we had to come back and provide additional support for the conservation officers, the corrections officers, the commerce fraud settlement. So that was done in the last 2 years, and Representative Eklund and I and Senator Ingebrigtsen carried that. The question I have for MMB is, my understanding is with that adjustment, particularly with the conservation officers, there was some glitch where it affected them somehow with that adjustment in terms of the dollar amounts, and they were bumped into, there was some problem. Are you aware of that problem that occurred with the conservation officer?
Ms. Leland.
Madam Chair and members, yes, I'm aware that there were some errors made on the payroll side. I don't work in the payroll department, but I understand that there were some errors that resulted in overpayments that needed to be collected, that are in the process of being collected back or may already be collected back at this point. But in terms of the actual wages that were part of the 2020 and 2021 adjustments and then the subsequent labor negotiations, I don't believe that there are issues related to the actual pay that people are receiving now. But in terms of the calculation and issuing of back pay, I think that there was an initial error that's in the process that has been corrected, and that's as much as I know about it.
Okay, and I'm going to ask that we keep the conversation to the public.
And Madam Chair,
follow up, Rep. Hansen.
I think that this whole discussion that we just had is indicative of why we need to spend a little time on, I mean, what I like what Representative Tabke is doing here, but because it always seems that this particular bargaining unit gets left out, and then challenges happen because it's a relatively small number of people, and we don't, we focus on the troopers, but there's other people that are still in the bargaining unit. So I just want to make sure when there are problems that they get corrected, so that people who maybe by the size of the bargaining unit doesn't affect their outcome, and I think that this bill helps them.
Thank you. And then Lead Nash, you have a question.
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd request a roll call.
Roll call has been. That is the first time I've seen a microphone fall through the table. And we will talk about the redevelopment of the SOB at some point in the future. Representative Tabke, would you like to wrap up your bill so we can move to a roll call?
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and thank you, everyone, for the support for this bill. As you'll see in the packet, there are letters from the other from other folks in the, within the bargaining unit as well, and I do not disagree with anything MMB has said on the concerns that are around doing this. It is absolutely, we respect and appreciate everything that everyone across the state is doing for the citizens, and with that as well, this we also are establishing legislative intent and the understanding that this is a different type of bargaining unit that we will be that we would like to treat to recognize differently with other folks as it moves forward. So I just look forward to everyone's support, and we'll head to transportation.
Thank you very much. And with that, I just want to be really clear about what we're voting on. I renew my motion that House File 1600 be re-referred to the Transportation Committee. And with that, I will ask for the roll call to be taken.
Chair Cleavorn.
Aye.
Chair Cleavorn, aye. Vice Chair Hewitt.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hewitt, aye. Representative Nash.
Aye.
Representative Nash, aye. Representative Bonner.
Aye.
Representative Bonner, aye. Representative Berg.
Aye.
Representative Berg, aye. Representative Freiberg.
Yes.
Representative Freiberg, aye. Representative Hansen.
Aye.
Representative Hansen, aye. Representative Harder.
Aye.
Representative Harder, aye. Representative Herr.
Aye.
Representative Herr, aye. Representative Joy.
Aye.
Representative Joy, aye. Representative Kosnick.
Aye.
Representative Kosnick, aye. Representative Nadeau.
Aye.
Representative Nadeau, aye. Representative Newton.
Aye.
Representative Newton, aye. The ayes are 13, the nays are 0.
With 13 ayes and 0 nays, the motion prevails, and House File 1600 is re-referred to the Transportation Committee. Okay, with that, members, our business has been concluded. Our next meeting will be on Thursday. And with that, this meeting is adjourned.